Jeg er nu Rath, Yggdrasils, Heers Elgrim, for Ejes Dunor, Ugras, og Skrund, Ejstæ, Abelia, Yggdrasils, Nura Numa Aya, Zro.
Welcome to the 80th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. We'll be starting with the next part of Through the Brazilian Wilderness, then we'll have a 1921 cylinder recording, and then we'll go on to the second part of The Willows. Let's get started. Colonel Rondon and Lieutenant Lyra held many discussions as to whither the Rio do Duvida flowed, and where its mouth might be. Its provisional name, the River of Doubt, was given it precisely because of this ignorance concerning it, an ignorance which it was one of the purposes of our trip to dispel. It might go into the Gy Parana, in which case its course must be very short. It might flow into the Madeira low down, in which case its course could be very, very long. Or, which was unlikely, it might flow into the Tapajós. There was another river, of which Colonel Rondon had come across the headwaters, whose course was equally doubtful, although in its case there was a rather more probability of its flowing into the Juruna, by which name the Tapajós is known for its upper half. To this unknown river Colonel Rondon had given the name Ananas, because when he came across it he found a deserted Indian field with pineapples, which the hungry explorers ate greedily. Among the things the Colonel and I had hoped to accomplish on the trip was to do a little work in clearing up one or the other of these two doubtful geographical points, and thereby push a little forward the knowledge of this region. Originally, as described in the first chapter, my trip was undertaken primarily in the interest of the American Museum of Natural History in New York, to add to our knowledge of the birds and mammals and the far interior of Western Brazil wilderness, and the labels of our baggage and scientific equipment printed by the museum were entitled Colonel Roosevelt's South American Expedition for the American Museum of Natural History. But as I have already mentioned, at Rio the Brazilian government, through the Secretary of Foreign Affairs, Dr. Lauro Müller, suggested that I should combine the expedition with one by Colonel Rondon, which they contemplated making, and thereby make both expeditions of broader scientific interest. I accepted the proposal with much pleasure, and we found, when we joined Colonel Rondon and his associates, that their baggage and equipment had been labelled by the Brazilian government Expedicao Scientifica Roosevelt Rondon. This thenceforth became the proper and official title of the expedition. Cherry and Miller did the chief zoological work. The geological work was done by a Brazilian member of the expedition, Eusebio Oliveira. The astronomical work, necessary for obtaining the exact geographical location of the rivers and points of note, was to be done by Lieutenant Lyra, under the supervision of Colonel Rondon. And at the telegraph stations, this astronomical work would be checked by wire communications with one of Colonel Rondon's assistants at Cubaya, Lieutenant Catiano thereby securing a minutely accurate comparison of time. The sketch maps and surveying and cartographical work generally were to be made under the supervision of Colonel Rondon by Lyra, with assistance from Fiella and Kermit. Captain Amilcar handled the worst problem, transportation. The medical member was Dr. Cajazeera. At night around the campfire, my Brazilian companions often spoke of the first explorers of this vast wilderness of Western Brazil, men whose very names are now hardly known, but who did each his part in opening the country which will some day see such growth and development. Among the most notable of them was a Portuguese, Ricardo Franco, who spent 40 years at the work, during the last quarter of the 18th and opening years of the 19th centuries. He ascended for long distances the Zingo and the Tapajós, and went up the Madeira and the Garapó, crossing to the headwaters of the Paraguay and partially exploring there also. He worked among and with the Indians, much as Mungo Park worked with the natives of West Africa, having none of the aids, instruments, and comforts with which even the hardiest of modern explorers are provided. He was one of the men who established the beginnings of the province of Mato Grosso. For many years, the sole method of communication between this remote interior province and civilization was by the long, difficult, and perilous route which led up the Amazon and Madeira, and its then capital, the town of Mato Grosso, was the seat of the Captain General, with its palace, cathedral, and fortress, was accordingly placed far to the west near the Garapó. When less roundabout lines of communication were established further eastward, the old capital was abandoned, and the tropic wilderness surged over the lonely little town. The tomb of the old colonial explorer still stands in the ruined cathedral where the forest has once more come into its own. But civilization is again advancing to reclaim the lost town and to revive the memory of the wilderness wanderer who helped to found it. Colonel Rondon has named a river after Franco. A range of mountains has also been named after him. And the colonel, acting for the Brazilian government, has established a telegraph station in what was once the palace of the Captain General. Our northward trail led along the high ground, a league or two to the east of the northward flowing Rio Sacra. Each night we camped on one of the small tributary brooks that fed it. Fiala, Kermit, and I occupied one tent. In the daytime, the peum flies, vicious little sandflies, became bad enough to make us finally use gloves and head nets. There were many heavy rains, which made the travelling hard for the mules. The soil was more often clay than sand, and it was slippery when wet. The weather was overcast, and there was usually no oppressive heat even at noon. At intervals along the trail, we came on the staring skull and bleached skeleton of a mule or ox. Day after day we rode forward across these endless flats of grass and low open scrubby forest, the trees standing far apart and in most places being but little higher than the head of a horseman. Some of these carried blossoms, white, orange, yellow, and pink, and there were many flowers, the most beautiful being the morning glories. After the trees were bastard rubber trees and dwarf palmetto. If the latter grew more than a few feet high, their tops were torn and dishevelled by the wind. There was very little bird or mammal life, and there were few long vistas, for in most places it was not possible to see far among the grey gnarled trunks of the wind-beaten little trees. Yet the desolate landscape had a certain charm of its own, although not a charm that would be felt by any man who does not take pleasure in mere space, freedom, wilderness, and in plains standing empty to the sun, the wind, and the rain. The country bore some resemblance to the country west of Redaf, on the White Nile, the home of the giant Elland. Only here there was no big game, no chance of seeing the towering form of the giraffe, the black bulk of the elephant or buffalo, the herds of straw-coloured hartebeests, or the ghostly shimmer of the sun gleating on the coats of the roan and the elrond as they vanished silently in the grey sea of withered scrub. One feature in common with the African landscape was the abundance of anthills, some as high as a man. They were red in the clay country, grey where it was sandy, and the dirt houses were also in the trees, while their raised tunnels traversed trees and ground alike. At some of the camping places, we had to be on our watch against the swarms of leaf-carrying ants. These are so called in the books. The Brazilians call them carregadores, or porters, because they are always carrying bits of leaves and blades of grass to their underground homes. They are inveterate burden-bearers, and they industriously cut into pieces and carry off any garment they can get at, and we had to guard our shoes and clothes from them, just as we had to often guard all of our belongings against the termites. These ants did not bite us, but we encountered huge black ants, 1.25 inches long, which were very vicious, and their bite was not only painful, but often quite poisonous. Praying mantes were also common, and one evening at supper one had a comical encounter with a young dog, a jovial near puppy of Colonel Rondon's named Cartucho. He had been christened the Jolly Cum Pup from a character in one of Frank Stockton's stories, which I suppose are now remembered only by the elderly people, and by them only if they are natives of the United States. Cartucho was lying with his head on the oxhide that served as a table, waiting with poorly dissembled impatience for his share of the banquet. The mantis flew down onto the oxhide and proceeded to crawl over it, taking little flights from one corner to another, and whenever it thought itself menaced, it assumed an attitude of seeming devotion and real defiance. Soon it lit in front of Cartucho's nose. The dog cocked his big ears forward, stretched his neck, and cautiously sniffed at the new arrival, not with any hostile design, but merely to find out whether it would prove to be a playmate. The mantis promptly assumed an attitude of prayer. This struck Cartucho as something novel and interesting, and he thrust his sniffing black nose still nearer. The mantis dexterously thrust forward first one and then the other armed foreleg, touching the intrusive nose, which was instantly jerked back and again slowly and inquiringly brought forward. Then the mantis suddenly flew in Cartucho's face, whereupon Cartucho, with a smothered yelp of dismay, almost turned a back somersault and the triumphant mantis flew back to the middle of the oxhide among the plates, where it reared erect and defied the laughing and applauding company. Today's recording is a cylinder from 1921. It's called Honey and is sung by Olive Briscoe. Now on to the main feature. The Willows by Algernon Blackwood. Part 2. "You've been gone so long," he shouted above the wind. "I thought something must have happened to you." But there was in his tone, and a certain look in his face as well, that conveyed to me more than his usual words, and in a flash I understood the real reason for his coming. It was because the spell of the place had entered his soul too, and he did not like being alone. "River still rising," he cried, pointing to the flood in the moonlight, "and the wind's simply awful." He always said the same things, but it was the cry for companionship that gave the real importance to his words. "Lucky," I cried back, "our tent's in a hollow. I think it'll hold all right." I added something about the difficulty of finding wood in order to explain my absence, but the wind caught my words and flung them across the river, so that he did not hear, but just looked at me through the branches, nodding his head. "Lucky if we get away without disaster," he shouted, or words to that effect. And I remember feeling half angry with him for putting the thought into words, for it was exactly what I felt myself. There was disaster impending somewhere, and the sense of presentiment lay unpleasantly upon me. We went back to the fire and made a final blaze, poking it up with our feet. We took a last look round. But for the wind, the heat would have been unpleasant. I put this thought into words, and I remember my friend's reply struck me oddly, that he would rather have the heat, the ordinary July weather, than this diabolical wind. Everything was snug for the night, the canoe lying turned over beside the tent, with both yellow paddles beneath her, the provision sack hanging from a willow stem, and the washed-up dishes removed to a safe distance from the fire, all ready for the morning meal. We smothered the embers of the fire with sand, and then turned in. The flap of the tent door was up, and I saw the branches and the stars and the white moonlight. The shaking willows and the heavy buffeting of the wind against our taut little house were the last things I remembered as sleep came down and covered all with its soft and delicious forgetfulness. Suddenly I found myself lying awake, peering from my sandy mattress through the door of the tent. I looked at my watch pinned against the canvas, and saw by the bright moonlight that it was 12 o'clock, the threshold of a new day, and I had therefore slept a couple of hours. The Swede was asleep still beside me. The wind howled as before. Something plucked at my heart and made me feel afraid. There was a sense of disturbance in my immediate neighbourhood. I sat up quickly and looked out. The trees were swaying violently to and fro as the gusts smote them, but our little bit of green canvas lay snugly safe in the hollow, for the wind passed over it without meeting enough resistance to make it vicious. The feeling of disquietude did not pass, however, and I crawled quietly out of the tent to see if our belongings were safe. I moved carefully so as not to waken my companion. A curious excitement was on me. I was halfway out, kneeling on all fours, when my eye first took in that the tops of the bushes opposite, with their moving tracery of leaves, made shapes against the sky. I sat back on my haunches and stared. It was incredible, surely. But there, opposite and slightly above me, were shapes of some indeterminate sort among the willows, and as the branches swayed in the wind, they seemed to group themselves about these shapes, forming a series of monstrous outlines that shifted rapidly beneath the moon. Close, about 50 feet in front of me, I saw these things. My first instinct was to waken my companion, that he too might see them. But something made me hesitate, the sudden realization, probably, that I should not welcome the corroboration. And meanwhile, I crouched there, staring in amazement with smarting eyes. I was wide awake. I remember saying to myself that I was not dreaming. They first became properly visible, these huge figures, just within the tops of the bushes, immense, bronze-coloured, moving, and wholly independent of the swaying of the branches. I saw them plainly, and noted, now I came to examine them more calmly, that they were very much larger than human, and indeed that something in their appearance proclaimed them to be not human at all. Certainly they were not merely the moving tracery of the branches against the moonlight. They shifted independently. They rose upwards in a continuous stream from the earth to the sky, vanishing utterly as soon as they reached the dark of the sky. They were interlaced one with another, making a great column, and I saw their limbs and huge bodies melting in and out of each other, forming this serpentine line that bent and swayed and twisted spirally with the other contortions of the wind-tossed trees. They were nude, fluid shapes, passing up the bushes, within the leaves almost, rising up in a living column into the heavens. Their faces I could never see. Unceasingly they poured upwards, swaying in great bending curves with a hue of dull bronze upon their skins. I stared, trying to force every atom of vision from my eyes. For a long time, I thought they must every moment disappear and resolve themselves into the movements of the branches and prove to be an optical illusion. I searched everywhere for a proof of reality, when all the while I understood quite well that the standard of reality had changed. For the longer I looked, the more certain I became that these figures were real and living, though perhaps not according to the standards that the camera and the biologist would insist upon. Far from feeling fear, I was possessed with a sense of awe and wonder, such as I had never known. I seemed to be gazing at the personified elemental forces of this haunted and primeval region. Our intrusion had stirred the powers of the place into activity. It was we who were the cause of the disturbance, and my brain filled to bursting with stories and legends, the spirits and deities of places that must have been acknowledged and worshipped by men in all ages of the world's history. But before I could arrive at any possible explanation, something impelled me to go further out, and I crept forward on the sand and stood upright. I felt the ground still warm under my bare feet. The wind tore at my hair and face, and the sound of the river burst upon my ears with a sudden roar. These things I knew were real, and proved that my senses were acting normally. Yet the figures still rose from the earth to heaven, silent, majestically, in a great spiral of grace and strength that overwhelmed me at length with a genuine deep emotion of worship. I felt that I must fall down and worship, absolutely worship. Perhaps in another minute I might have done so, when a gust of wind swept against me with such force that it blew me sideways, and I nearly stumbled and fell. It seemed to shake the dream violently out of me. At least it gave me another point of view somehow. The figure still remained, still ascended into heaven from the heart of the night, but my reason at last began to assert itself. It must be a subjective experience, I argued, none the less real for that, but still subjective. The moonlight and the branches combined to work out these pictures for me on the mirror of my imagination, and for some reason I projected them outwards and made them appear objective. I knew this must be the case, of course. I took courage and began to move forward across the open patches of sand. By Jove, though, was it all a hallucination? Was it merely subjective? Did not my reason argue in the old futile way from the little standard of the known? I only know that the great column of figures ascended darkly into the sky for what seemed a very long period of time, and with a very complete measure of reality, as most men are accustomed to gauge reality. Then suddenly they were gone. And once they were gone, and the immediate wonder of their great presence had passed, fear came down upon me with a cold rush. The esoteric meaning of this lonely and haunted region suddenly flamed up within me, and I began to tremble dreadfully. I took a quick look around, a look of horror that came near to panic, calculating vainly ways of escape. And then, realizing how helpless I was to achieve anything really effective, I crept back silently into the tent and lay down again upon the sandy mattress, first lowering the door curtain to shut out the sight of the willows in the moonlight, and then burying my head as deeply as possible beneath the blankets to deaden the sound of the terrifying wind. As though further to convince me that I had not been dreaming, I remember that it was a long time before I fell again into a troubled and restless sleep, and even then only the upper crust of me slept, and underneath there was something that never quite lost consciousness, but lay alert and on the watch. But this second time I jumped up with a genuine start of terror. It was neither the wind nor the river that woke me, but the slow approach of something that caused the sleeping portion of me to grow smaller and smaller, till at last it vanished altogether, and I found myself sitting bolt upright, listening. Outside there was a sound of multitudinous little patterings. They had been coming, I was aware, for a long time, and in my sleep they had first become audible. I sat there nervously wide awake, as though I had not slept at all. It seemed to me that my breathing came with difficulty, and that there was a great weight upon the surface of my body. In spite of the hot night, I felt clammy with cold and shivered. Something surely was pressing steadily against the sides of the tent and weighing down upon it from above. Was it the body of the wind? Was this the pattering rain, the dripping of leaves? The spray blown from the river by the wind and gathering in big drops? I thought quickly of a dozen things. Then suddenly the explanation leaped into my mind. A bough from the poplar, the only large tree on the island, had fallen with the wind. Still half caught with the other branches, it would fall with the next gust and crush us, and meanwhile its leaves brushed and tapped upon the tight canvas surface of the tent. I raised a loose flap and rushed out, calling to the Swede to follow. But when I got out and stood upright, I saw that the tent was free. There was no hanging bough. There was no rain or spray. Nothing approached. A cold grey light filtered down through the bushes and lay on the faintly gleaming sand. Stars still crowded the sky directly overhead, and the wind howled magnificently. But the fire no longer gave out any glow, and I saw the east reddening in streaks through the trees. Several hours must have passed since I stood there before watching the ascending figures, and the memory of it now came back to me horribly, like an evil dream. Oh, how tired it made me feel, that ceaseless raging wind. Yet, though the deep lassitudes of a sleepless night was on me, my nerves were tingling with the activity of an equally tireless apprehension, and all idea of repose was out of the question. The river I saw had risen further. Its thunder filled the air, and a fine spray made itself felt through my thin sleeping shirt. Yet nowhere did I discover the slightest evidence of anything to cause alarm. This deep, prolonged disturbance in my heart remained wholly unaccounted for. My companion had not stirred when I called him, and there was no need to waken him now. I looked about me carefully, noting everything. The turned-over canoe, the yellow paddles, two of them, I'm certain, the provision sack and the extra lantern hanging together from the tree, and crowding everywhere about me, enveloping all, the willows, those endless, shaking willows. A bird uttered its morning cry, and a string of duck passed with whirring flight overhead in the twilight. The sand whirled dry and stinging about my bare feet in the wind. I walked round the tent and went out a little way into the bush so that I could see across the river to the farther landscape, and the same profound yet indefinable emotion of distress seized upon me again as I saw the interminable sea of bushes stretching to the horizon, looking ghostly and unreal in the wan light of dawn. I walked softly here and there, still puzzling over that odd sound of infinite pattering and of that pressure upon the tent that had wakened me. It must have been the wind, I reflected, the wind bearing upon the loose hot sand, driving the dry particles smartly against the taut canvas, the wind dropping heavily upon our fragile roof. Yet all the time my nervousness and malaise increased appreciably. I crossed over to the farther shore, and noted how the coastline had altered in the night, and what masses of sand the river had torn away. I dipped my hands and feet into the cool current, and bathed my forehead. Already there was a glow of sunrise in the sky, and the exquisite freshness of coming day. On my way back, I passed purposefully beneath the very bushes where I had seen the column of figures rising into the air, and midway among the clumps, I suddenly found myself overtaken by a sense of vast terror. From the shadows, a large figure went swiftly by. Someone passed me, as sure as ever a man did. It was a great staggering blow from the wind that helped me forward again, and once out in the more open space, the sense of terror diminished strangely. The winds were about and walking. I remember saying to myself, for the winds often move like great presences under the trees, and altogether the fear that hovered about me was such an unknown and immense kind of fear, so unlike anything that I have ever felt before, that it woke a sense of awe and wonder in me that did much to counteract its worse effects. And when I reached a high point in the middle of the island from which I could see the wide stretch of the river, crimson in the sunrise, the whole magical beauty of it all was so overpowering that a sort of wild yearning woke in me and almost brought a cry up into the throat. But this cry found no expression, for as my eyes wandered from the plain beyond to the island round me, and noted our little tent half hidden among the willows, a dreadful discovery leapt out at me, compared to which my terror of the walking winds seemed as nothing at all. For a change, I thought, had somehow come about in the arrangement of the landscape. It was not that my point of vantage gave me a different view, but that an alteration had apparently been effected in the relation of the tent to the willows, and of the willows to the tent. Surely the bushes now crowded much closer, unnecessarily unpleasantly close. They had moved nearer. Creeping with silent feet over the shifting sands, drawing imperceptibly nearer by soft, unhurried movements, the willows had come closer during the night. But had the wind moved them, or had they moved themselves? I recalled the sound of infinite small patterings, and the pressure upon the tent and upon my own heart that caused me to wake in terror. I swayed for a moment in the wind, like a tree, finding it hard to keep my upright position on the sandy hillock. There was a suggestion here of personal agency, of deliberate intention of aggressive hostility, and it terrified me into a sort of rigidity. Then the reaction followed quickly. The idea was so bizarre, so absurd, that I felt inclined to laugh. But the laughter came no more readily than the cry, for the knowledge that my mind was so receptive to such dangerous imaginings brought the additional terror that it was as though our minds and not through our physical bodies that the attack would come, and was coming. The wind buffeted me about, and very quickly it seemed the sun came up over the horizon, for it was after 4 o'clock, and I must have stood on the little pinnacle of sand longer than I knew, afraid to come down to close quarters with the willows. I returned quietly, creepily, to the tent, first taking another exhaustive look round, and, yes, I confess it, making a few measurements. I paced out on the warm sand the distance between the willows and the tent, making a note of the shortest distance particularly. I crawled stealthily into my blankets. My companion, to all appearances, still slept soundly, and I was glad that this was so. Provided my experiences were not corroborated, I could find strength somehow to deny them. With the daylight, I could persuade myself that this was all a subjective hallucination, a fantasy of the night, a projection of the excited imagination. Nothing further came in to disturb me, and I fell asleep almost at once, utterly exhausted, yet still in dread of hearing again that weird sound of multitudinous pattering, or of feeling the pressure upon my heart that had made it difficult to breathe. The sun was high in the heavens when my companion woke me from a heavy sleep and announced that the porridge was cooked and there was just time to bathe. The grateful smell of frizzling bacon entered the door tent. "River still rising," he said, "and several islands out in the middle stream have disappeared altogether. Our own island's much smaller." "Any wood left?" I asked sleepily. "The wood and the island will finish tomorrow in a dead heat," he laughed, "but there's enough to last till then." I plunged in from the point of the island, which had indeed altered a lot in size and shape during the night, and was swept down in a moment to the landing place opposite the tent. The water was icy, and the banks flew by like the country from an express train. Bathing under such conditions was an exhilarating operation, and the terror of the night seemed cleansed out of me by a process of evaporation in the brain. The sun was blazing hot, not a cloud showed itself anywhere. The wind, however, had not abated one little jot. Quite suddenly, then, the implied meaning of the Swede's words flashed across me, showing that he no longer wished to leave post-haste, and had changed his mind. Enough to last till tomorrow. He assumed we would stay on the island another night. It struck me as odd. The night before was so positive the other way around. How had the change come about? Great crumblings of the bank occurred at breakfast, with heavy splashings and clouds of spray which the wind brought into our frying pan, and my fellow traveller talked incessantly about the difficulty the Vienna Pest streamers must have to find a channel in flood. But the state of his mind interested and impressed me far more than the state of the river or the difficulties of the steamers. He had changed somehow since the evening before. His manner was different, a trifle excited, a trifle shy, with a sort of suspicion about his voice and gesture. I hardly know how to describe it in cold blood, but at the time I remember being quite certain of one thing, that he had become frightened. He ate very little breakfast, and for once omitted to smoke his pipe. He had the map spread open beside him, and kept studying its markings. "We'd better get off sharp in an hour," I said presently, feeling for an opening that must bring him in directly to a partial confession at any rate. And his answer puzzled me uncomfortably. "Rather, if they'll let us." "Who'll let us? The elements?" I asked quickly, with affected indifference. "The powers of this awful place, whoever they are," he replied, keeping his eyes on the map. "The gods are here, if they're anywhere at all in the world." "The elements are always the true immortals," I replied, laughing as naturally as I could manage, yet knowing quite well that my face reflected my true feelings when he looked up gravely at me and spoke across the smoke. "We shall be fortunate if we can get away without further disaster." This was exactly what I had dreaded, and I screwed myself up to the point of the direct question. It was like agreeing to allow the dentist to extract the tooth. It had come anyhow in the long run, and the rest was all pretense. "Further disaster? Why, what's happened?" "For one thing, the steering paddle's gone," he said quietly. "The steering paddle's gone," I repeated, greatly excited, for this was our rudder, and the Danube in flood without a rudder was suicide. "But what?"
"And there's a tear in the bottom of the canoe," he added with a genuine little tremor in his voice.
I continued staring at him, able only to repeat the words in his face somewhat foolishly. There in the heat of the sun and on this burning sand, I was aware of a freezing atmosphere descending round us. I got up to follow him, for he merely nodded his head gravely and led the way towards the tent a few yards on the other side of the fireplace. The canoe still lay there as I had last seen it in the night, ribs uppermost, the paddles, or rather the paddle, on the sand beside her.
"There's only one," he said, stooping to pick it up. "And here's the rent in the baseboard."
It was on the tip of my tongue to tell him that I had clearly noticed the two paddles a few hours before, but a second impulse made me think better of it, and I said nothing. I approached to see. There was a long, finely made tear in the bottom of the canoe where a little slither of wood had been neatly taken clean out. It looked as if the tooth of a sharp rock or snag had beaten down the length, and investigation showed where the hole went through. Had we launched out in her without observing it, we must inevitably have foundered. At first, the water would have made the wood swell so as to close the hole, but once out in midstream, the water must have poured in, and the canoe, never more than 2 inches above the surface, would have filled and sunk very rapidly.
"There, you see an attempt to prepare a victim for the sacrifice," I heard him saying, more to himself than to me. "Two victims, rather," he added as he bent over and ran his fingers along the slit.
I began to whistle, a thing I always do unconsciously when utterly nonplussed, and purposefully paid no attention to his words. I was determined to consider them foolish.
"It wasn't there last night," he said presently, straightening up from his examination and looking anywhere but at me. "We must have scratched her in the landing, of course."
I stopped whistling to say, "The stones are very sharp." I stopped abruptly, for at that moment he turned round and met my eye squarely. I knew just as well as he did how impossible my explanation was. There were no stones to begin with.
"And then there's this to explain too," he added quietly, handing me the paddle and pointing to the blade.
A new and curious emotion spread freezingly over me as I took and examined it. The blade was scraped down all over, beautifully scraped, as though someone had sandpapered it with care, making it so thin that the first vicious stroke must have snapped it off at the elbow.
"One of us walked in his sleep and did this thing," I said feebly, or it has been filed by the constant stream of sand particles blown against it by the wind, perhaps."
"Ah," said the Swede, turning away, laughing a little, "you can explain everything."
"That same wind that caught the steering paddle and flung it so near the bank that it fell in with the next lump that crumbled," I called out after him, absolutely determined to find an explanation for everything he showed me.
"I see," he shouted back, turning his head to look at me before disappearing among the willow bushes. Once alone with these perplexing evidences of personal agency, I think my first thoughts took the form of, "One of us must have done this thing, and it certainly was not I." But my second thought decided how impossible it was to suppose, under all the circumstances, that either of us had done it, that my companion, the trusted friend of a dozen similar expeditions, could have knowingly had a hand in it, was a suggestion not to be entertained for a moment. Equally absurd seemed the explanation that this imperturbable and densely practical nature had suddenly become insane and was busied with insane purposes. Yet the fact remained that what disturbed me most and kept my fear actively alive even in the blaze of sunshine and wild beauty was the clear certainty that some curious alteration had come about in his mind, that he was nervous, timid, suspicious, aware of goings-on he did not speak about, watching a series of secret and hitherto unmentionable events, waiting, in a word, for a climax that he expected, and I thought expected very soon. This grew in my mind intuitively. I hardly knew how. I made a hurried examination of the tent and its surroundings, but the measurements of the night remained the same. There were deep hollows formed in the sand, I now noticed for the first time, basin-shaped and of various depths and sizes, varying from a teacup to a large bowl. The wind, no doubt, was responsible for these miniature craters, just as it was for lifting the paddle and tossing it towards the water.
The rent in the canoe was the only thing that seemed quite inexplicable, and after all, it was conceivable that a sharp point had caught it when we landed. The examination I made of the shore did not assist in this theory, but all the same I clung to it with the diminishing portion of my intelligence, which I called my reason. An explanation of some kind was an absolute necessity, just as some working explanation of the universe is necessary, however absurd, to the happiness of every individual who seeks to do his duty in the world and face the problems of life. The simile seemed to me at the time an exact parallel. I at once set about pitch-melting, and presently the Swede joined me at the work. Though not under the best conditions in the world, the canoe could not be safe for travelling till the following day. I drew his attention casually to the hollows in the sand. "Yes," he said, "I know, they're all over the island. But you can explain them, no doubt." "Wind, of course," I answered without hesitation. "Have you never watched those little whirlwinds in the street that twist and twirl everything into a circle? This sand's loose enough to yield, that's all." He made no reply, and we worked on in silence for a bit. I watched him surreptitiously all the time, and I had an idea he was watching me. He seemed, too, to be always listening attentively to something I could not hear, or perhaps for something that he expected to hear, for he kept turning about and staring into the bushes and up into the sky and out across the water where it was visible through the openings among the willows. Sometimes he even put his hand to his ear and held it there for several minutes. He said nothing to me, however, about it, and I asked no questions. And meanwhile, as he mended that torn canoe with the skill and address of a Red Indian, I was glad to notice his absorption in the work, for there was a vague dread in my heart that he would speak of the changed aspect of the willows. And if he had not noticed that, my imagination could no longer be held a sufficient explanation of it. And that's enough of the willows for today. I've just completed an interview for the Fistful of Podcasts podcast. So if you fancy hearing a little bit more of me, you might hook onto their feed, which you can find over at podbean.com. But be warned, they're not afraid to swear. That's all for today, except to remind you that the opening music is by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk